It's go time. Let's do this. Find a seat. Quit fellowship. Hey, I'm tired of all this fellowshipping that's going on. If you're new to church, that's Christianese for talking and hanging out and being kind to one another. All right, so my name is Austin. I'm not the principal communicator here, so if you don't like tonight, come back next week, and it'll be better. So let me pray, and then we'll get started. God, you're here, and that's enough. It's all we need. In Jesus' name, amen. Yes. Amen. After worship like that, honestly, I feel like I could just come up here and talk about anything, and it's going to be incredible. So that's my fault. So tonight, I'm new to this thing, okay? So tonight, we're going to continue our series on supernatural living, and we're going to talk about the process of progress, the process of progress. If you weren't here last week, man, Pastor Zach gave the best sermon he's ever given in his life, which was kind of, that was meant to be sarcasm because last week was canceled. So I didn't mean to set some people up, so I'll own that. So last week we didn't have service for the bad weather, but tonight the weather couldn't hold us back. We're here, it's gonna be awesome. We're gonna pick up where Pastor Zach left off in Hebrews. So Hebrews 6, 11 and 12, and we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness to have the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. Who through faith and patience inherit the promises. I don't know about you, but sometimes I need to hear something more than once for it to sink in. Anyone relate with that? Okay? So I want to start off where Pastor Zach left off with this. I'm going to go ahead and coin this. I'm going to go ahead and call this the grit equation. Okay, the grit equation. He talked about faith plus patience equals promises. If you've never had to walk through faith and patience to inherit a promise, it takes a lot of grit. Yeah. It takes a lot of grit. So we're going to talk about the grit equation some. And here's what's at stake. Okay, we have to be a people of faith and patience so that we can inherit promises, not only for ourselves, but for following generations. That's what's at stake here. That's why I feel like this is so important for us to get, and why I felt like this is where we need to start this week off with, because we have to be people of faith and patience that inherit promises, not just for ourselves, which is awesome, that's great, but also so that we can give an inheritance to another generation. You know, and inheritances are awesome, and they're more than just about, they're more than just material, they're more than just money. I want to be able to give my children and my children's children an inheritance. In Proverbs it says that a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. And I want to do that, and I want it to be more than just moth food. Right? I want it to be more than just money and material things. I want to leave an inheritance of faith and patience and promises for my kids and their kids, just like it was done for me. So around 2 years old, my grandpa had just bought my aunt, his daughter, a brand new white convertible Mustang. Okay? Slick, really nice. One day she walks out to this Mustang and notices that it has been keyed. All of the car people cringe on the inside. Okay, it's been keyed, and oddly enough, it's been keyed on the hood of the car, which is kind of odd. So anyway, she runs and goes and gets my mom and dad to come and check it out and start the investigation, you know, of the culprit. And so they're looking at these scratches and everything, and I don't know if they were planning on doing some sort of like handwriting analysis, personality profile type thing. But anyway, so they're looking at the scratches, and as they're looking, they're like, I mean, that scratch right there kind of looks like an A. And then the scratch after that, if you look at it just right, kind of looks like a U, and there's an S. So I'm 2 years old at the time, right? Which can only mean one thing. There was an accessory. There was a there was another person involved in this incident. And so they go and they get my grandpa, and they start questioning my grandpa. Daryl, do you notice anything on the hood of the car? Any scratches or anything like that? Yep. Did you teach your grandson to write his name by using a rock on the hood of the car? Yep. And so, of course, they're like, what in the world are you thinking? Like, why would you do that? How could you do that? And his response was just, I bought the car. And that's the only reasoning he gave, was just, I bought the car. And so through this, stories like this, years later, I would come into this awareness of it's okay to have things, but it's not okay for things to have you. And I truly believe that that was an inheritance that I received from my grandpa, and I could tell other stories. But see, the thing with an inheritance is you can give a gift to anyone, but an inheritance is meant for family. And the premise of an inheritance is what took someone years or decades or maybe an entire lifetime becomes another's in the blink of an eye. God is a God who thinks generationally. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Something really cool is, you remember in the story of Abraham, how Abraham had been given this promise of conceiving, or his wife conceiving a son. And it was such a central part of his story, and it took decades to see that promise come to pass. And it took a lot of faith, and it took a lot of patience to inherit that promise. So that son was born, his name was Isaac. And then in Genesis chapter 25, it tells this about Isaac. It says, Isaac prayed to the Lord because his wife was barren and couldn't conceive. So he prayed to the Lord. The very next verse is, and the Lord granted his prayer and his wife conceived. What happened? An inheritance was given. What took his dad decades was his in the moment, because an inheritance was received. That's what's at stake here. We have to be people who are committed to the grittiness of standing in faith, enduring patience, so that we can inherit promises, not just to receive, but also to give. And wouldn't it be awesome if like every situation was like that? Like someone else did the work for you and you just kind of got to inherit it? It's like, God, why could you not have chosen a different delivery method for promises besides patience? Like, have you looked at Amazon's approach, like their business model? Because it'd be awesome if we could get some of this stuff on Prime, you know, and like, oh, deliverance, yeah, totally, 2-day shipping, come on with it. Flu season, hey, flu season's on, or healing for the flu's on clearance because it's out of season. So do I need it? No. Is it on sale? Yes. So I'm buying it. How many of you know people like that? Like, if it's on sale, I'm buying it. I don't need it, but I'm buying it. How many of you are that person? Okay. At least you have some self-awareness. At least you have some self-awareness. That doesn't make sense to me, but that's fine. Here's why we like the idea of that. Is because we want the progress without the process. We want the promise without the patience. And therein lies our problem. It's because we want something that is contrary to the way that God actually works. We want the progress, but we don't necessarily want the process. I was driving down a road a couple weeks ago. The thing that you normally drive down, I don't know why I had to clarify that. So I'm driving a few weeks ago. I'm getting a nice back massage from all the potholes in the road. And I think to myself, man, someone really needs to do something about this road. Like, this is bad, you know, we need to fix this up, make it nice. I was just recently in the Dallas area, so I'm like, man, make it like McKinney, Lord, just like McKinney. 8-lane highways, everything's smooth, easy on, easy off, all that. And then it hit me like, are you seriously saying this right now? McKinney has been under construction since you've been born. Okay, it's the city that never ends construction. And you've hated it until now. And now Melissa's under construction. So it's like never ending. You know, and so I'm like, you know what? These potholes, they're not so bad. Because if we work on this road, that means there's going to be some traffic delays. There's going to be some detours. And heaven forbid I get inconvenienced. So you know what? The potholes, they're not that bad. They're okay. I can live with the potholes because I don't want to deal with the process of progress. So my question to you is, what are the potholes in your life? For some of you, it may be pot. I don't know. But what are the potholes in your life? What are the things that you know need to get fixed for you to grow, but you don't want to have to go through the process of getting them fixed? Some of you, you're in this process of God doing some work, and there's some detours, and there's some delay, and there's some inconvenience in your life. And it's a result of God doing some work in your heart where you thought, man, I thought by now I'd be here doing this. I thought by now I'd be over this issue. But yet here I am, and I'm in a place that's totally different than where I thought I would be by now. Maybe it's just a detour as God is preparing you so that when he places you in that position, you're actually able to step into it and sustain it. Because if you're not ready when the opportunity comes, you'll collapse. I want to talk to you about making the most out of the meantime. Again, if you're new to church, let me just explain what the meantime is. The meantime is the time between whenever you have a God-given dream, a God-given vision, a God-given call, and when that thing actually materializes, when you actually step into it. I think all of us, to some degree, in some way, are in the meantime. This is something that Pastor Zach talked about last time we were together. At some way, whether it's us or someone we're connected with, we're in the meantime. So there are tons of examples of throughout the Bible, and let me tell you this, you're not alone in going through the meantime. The Bible is filled with people who've experienced this, and there are tons of people we could choose from, but because we're talking about grit, I gotta go with the OG, I gotta go with the original grit, the original true grit. So before Jeff Bridges, before John Wayne, before Rooster Cogburn, there was King David, okay? The original true grit. That man had some grit about him. So we're gonna focus on a few things in his life that I think we can learn from and how to make the most out of the meantime. I don't know what the next slide is. Okay. Yeah, we'll get there. So let me set a little bit of context here before we jump into the slide I just showed you. Okay, spoiler alert. So here's where we're at in the history of Israel. This will be a brief history, okay? So hang in there, buckle up. So up till now, it's been individual tribes, and they've been led by judges, people who God has appointed to lead at certain times. Now enter Samuel, who's a prophet, and he's one of the key leaders in the nation at this time. And the Israelites come to Samuel and they say, listen, we want a king just like all the other nations have a king. Really whiny, like a small child who's like, hey, my friends have the ripped jeans with the bedazzled bottoms. I want those, you know, and like, okay, whatever. So that was not planned. So yeah, that totally threw me off. Sorry. Flashbacks. So anyway, we want a king just like all the other nations have a king. And Samuel's pretty, you know, he feels rejected. Have you ever felt rejected before? Like rejected by people? Okay. So what Samuel does with his rejection is he goes to God. Novel concept. You're rejected by men. Go to God. So he goes to God. And the Lord says, Samuel, don't worry about it. It's not you they're rejecting. It's me. They're rejecting me as their king. So give them what they want. Interesting that God gave something that they wanted, even though it wasn't what's best for them. So just give them what they want. So Samuel says, okay. He goes out, finds a tall, handsome, rugged, strong man. And I'm holding back all the jokes I can make right now. And his name's Saul. So Saul's appointed king. He looked like the ideal king on the outside. However, this guy had some major character issues going on in the inside. So he disobeys God. The Lord rejects him as being king. Samuel's heartbroken again. And the Lord comes to him and says, pull yourself up, brush yourself off, because I'm doing something new. I've got a new king that I'm coming after who's humble, who's got a heart after mine, and you're going to go to this town called Bethlehem. Go to the house of Jesse, and you'll find him there. So Jesse goes there, or Samuel goes there, and Jesse brings out all his sons, and again, he sees the oldest son, the biggest, the strongest. This must be the king. God says, no, that's not him. He goes through all the siblings, doesn't find the king, and says, Jesse, do you have any more sons that I need to know about? He says, well, actually, there's David. He's just out watching the sheep right now. He said, yeah, bring him in. So David comes in. He's just a boy. And God speaks to Samuel and says, this is the king. So Samuel anoints him as king around the age of 10 or 12. And so he does what any 10-year-old would do who's newly anointed to be king. He takes a selfie with Samuel and post it to his Insta. Hashtag king me, hashtag sorry Saul. And then he's like, come on, where's my robes? Where's my throne? Where's my privileges? And that's not at all what David did. David goes back to work. David goes back to work. Actually, he starts working two jobs. I know, watch out. Starts working two jobs. So David is anointed to be king around the age of 10. David is familiar with the meantime. Because here's what his timeline looks like. At 10 years old, he's anointed to be king. 15 years old, kills Goliath. So now it's like, okay, kill Goliath, it's my time, right? No. 25 years old, army commander. So now, like, now he's at the place, like any day now, Saul falls over and I'm in. Not the case. At 27 years old, he's actually on the run. Saul's trying to kill him. And it's not until he's 42 years old, 32 years later, that he becomes king. So he has a 32-year meantime. And even when he becomes king, it's not even all at one time. But God is faithful. And through the course of David's life, albeit not perfect, David chooses to live a life of faith and patience, and he inherits the promise of God. So this is where David's at, okay? So David is anointed to be king at age 10. He keeps doing his work. He picks up another job. He's doing that. One day his dad tells him, hey, I need you to take some food to your brothers who are out on the battlefield. So David goes out just to drop off some food, and he encounters, he steps into a war zone, right? So there's one army on one side, another army on the other, and the rules are set to where the champion for the Philistine army comes out, who's Goliath, giant, huge dude, and the champion selected from Israel, they haven't selected one yet because everyone's scared, the champions battle it out. Whoever wins gets to enslave the other nation. Okay, so pretty high stakes, I would say. Pretty high stakes. So this is where we pick it up in 1 Samuel 17. David shows up and he says this. He says, don't worry about this Philistine. David told Saul, I'll go fight him. Saul says, don't be ridiculous. There's no way you can fight this Philistine and possibly win. You're only a boy, and he's been a man of war since his youth. But David persisted. He said, I've been taking care of my father's sheep and goats. And when a lion or bear comes to steal a lamb from the flock, oh, I love this. I go after it with a club, and I rescue the lamb from its mouth. If the animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and club it to death. Come on. I've done this to both lions and bears, and I'll do it again. I'll do it again to this pagan Philistine, for he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the claws of the lion and the bear will rescue me from this Philistine. And Saul finally said, okay, go ahead. And may the Lord be with you. So how was David about, remember, he's around 15 years old at this time. How is he able to step into this moment with such confidence? How is he able to step into this moment and be ready? It's because David knew that the meantime isn't a waiting room. It's a training ground. The meantime isn't a waiting room. It's a training ground. As you're in that meantime, the time between whenever God gives you a dream, gives you a call, gives you a vision, and when it actually comes to pass, it's not a time to sit around and read magazines. It's a time to prepare. It's a time to get ready. Whenever he was anointed to be king, he didn't sit back and go, God's got this. Like, I can just take it easy and everything's going to work out okay. Whenever we went to Saul and he persisted, so he goes to Saul and says, I'm ready to do this. And Saul says, no, there's no way. There's no way. He didn't reply back with, but I'm anointed to be king. Come on. Like, don't you see? Like, I'm anointed to be king. I'm entitled to this. What he said is he showed his record. He said, here's what I've been doing in the meantime. Here's what I've been doing. Here's what's made me ready. I think a lot of times whenever that moment comes, and if we've treated the meantime like a waiting room, that moment comes and it's our time to step into the moment, and we get told no, and we push back and we persist, what do we have to say we're ready for this moment? Like, if you've been treating it like a waiting room, that moment comes and it's God told me that I would do this. Well, have you been preparing for it? Have you been getting ready? David stepped in that moment, and I just imagine what's going on in his head, because you know the devil's talking to him. You know that the enemy's trying to keep him from doing this. I mean, every time you're at the cusp of one of these defining moments, the devil's going to be talking to you. If the devil's not talking to you, and if you're not experiencing opposition from the devil, you may be going the same direction he's going. So I just imagine what tactics the enemy's using in this moment. And I'm thinking, he's like, David, come on, you're anointed to be king. What are you doing? Play it safe. Play it safe. Like, if you just play your cards right, it'll be okay. There's no need to risk your life now. This isn't for the throne. And I just love this about David, that he had this tenacity, this grit of, if I'm not going to be a king today, if I'm not going to be a king today, I'm not going to be a king tomorrow. If I'm not going to step in into courage and step up for my nation now, I'm not going to do it down the road. It's now or never. And he had that tenacity about him. And he said, you know what? I've seen God come through with me, or come through for me before, and he's going to do it again. I've seen him do it before, and I'm going to see him do it again. I love that tenacity. Man, there's something when you see someone step into a moment like that of confidence and courage and full of faith. I'm not talking about just egocentric type stuff. I'm talking about filled with faith. They step into that moment. There's something contagious about that. There's something that when you look at people who live lives of faithfulness, again, what Pastor Zach's talked about, not just faith-filled moments, but a lifetime of faithfulness. When you see people do that, it inspires you. And when I see David do this, or things like when the Hebrew boys, we're about to get thrown into the fire. I love what they said to the king. They said, you know what? Our God's going to come through for us. He's going to rescue us. It's going to be okay. But even if he doesn't, I'm not bowing my knee to you. Man, there's something about that that's grit. That's just true grit. My God's coming through for me, but even if he doesn't, I'm not bowing down to you. I'm not bowing down to you. So David steps into this moment, and because he treated the meantime like a training ground, not a waiting room, he was able to step into this moment fully. Because he was faithful with the flock, God gave him a nation. Because he was faithful in the little, wherever he was placed at, he was faithful. God promoted him. One of the craziest things about this story to me is that Saul let him do it. Have you ever thought about that? Saul let him do it. I mean, the stakes are, if this boy loses, which it looks like he's going to, if the boy loses, not only is a nation's freedom lost, but King Saul's own personal freedom is lost. I can't believe that Saul let him do it. I mean, there is no way. In fact, in verse 33 says, don't be ridiculous. There's no way you can fight this Philistine. There's no way. No way. The other thing I want you to get a hold of tonight is something that all of you already know, but probably five of you truly believe. And it's this: there is always a way. In everything, there is always a way when it comes to God's promises. David knew this. Because see, this wasn't the first time that he found himself in a no-way situation. I don't know what the next slide is. This wasn't the first time he found himself in a no-way situation. I mean, there's no way that Samuel's going to pick him out of 9 siblings. There's no way that some boy, 10-year-old boy in some inconspicuous town is going to rise up to be king. I mean, the royal lineage has already been established. There's no way. There's no way. He didn't have the right last name. He wasn't born in the right house. He wasn't born in the right city. He wasn't the right height. He wasn't big enough. All these things. And he very easily could have adapted a victim mentality of, there's just no way. The cards are stacked against me. There's no way I'm stepping into this. Now, I want to take a moment to address that victim mentality, because from probably, you know, most of us think of extremes. Like, we think people with a victim mentality, when we think of that, we think of the extreme cases. But I would venture to say that probably, I would say everyone in here, either at some point or currently, has found themselves in a victim mentality. So I want to spend a few minutes talking about this victim mentality and that there's always a way. So I want to do this by showing you a visual aid, something that we all know, but this should hopefully maybe help us by putting some language to it. This is not original with me. About 50 years ago, a guy by the name of Dr. Cartman, that's Carpman, not Cartman. I'm not quoting South Park up here because Jesus would leave the building. Dr. Cartman, it was later built upon by a guy by the name of David Emerald. Really cool. Some of our teammates and congregants got to meet this guy, I think like actually today or yesterday. So anyway, it's really cool. But this is something that was introduced to me a couple years ago, and ever since then, I've just been learning more and more about this. And that is what is called the drama triangle. The drama triangle. So there are three players in this. First is the victim. The victim is the most central person in everything that's going on here. So you have the victim who is below the persecutor and the rescuer. So we're going to dive into each of these people. And again, that was just a visual aid expressing the dynamic of a victim mentality. So the victim feels acted upon by external forces, feels helpless, hopeless, feels like their experience is beyond their control. Feels like because of something out there, because of either someone else or a certain circumstance, they take upon this mentality of poor me. They also say things like there's no way and I can't do anything about it. They feel defeated and powerless. And they do that because of the persecutor. So again, the persecutor is one of the players in this dynamic. The persecutor aggressively blames and shames. This is key. The persecutor could be a person, but it could also be a condition or a circumstance. So for example, with conditions or circumstances, you hate your job. Okay, let's just pretend like you hate your job. I know everyone here loves their job. But let's say you really didn't like your job, or you didn't like someone you worked with, and you feel powerless about that, and you feel like there's nothing you can do to change it, and you live under that. So a persecutor could be an actual person, could be a condition, could be a circumstance like a natural disaster, could be a circumstance like an economic downturn, things like that. Like victims, persecutors act out of fear. They may seem fearless, but they're almost always former victims. They use language like it's all your fault and what's wrong with you. It's the persecutor. And then you have the rescuer, which you would think like, yes, the good person. Okay. But it's not always the best. In fact, it's never the best. So the rescuer tries to alleviate or lessen the victim's fear or other negative feelings. The rescuer usually steps in with a sincere intention to help. But what they actually do is they provide relief, not help. That's something that Pastor Lee had taught me, is there's a big difference between relief and help. And before I can help anyone, I need to know what they want. If you want relief, I'm not your guy. If you want help, I can help you. So the rescuer actually comes in with the rescuer typically needs to be needed. They're there to help people, not actually to help them, but to feel needed. They address the person's feelings, and they want to shelter them from their feelings, not actually work towards solving the problem. Just like the persecutor, the rescuer isn't always a person. It could be things like addiction to drugs or alcohol or workaholism or sexual addiction. So for example, going back to our work situation, you don't enjoy your job, so you feel acted upon, there's nothing you can do about it, so you're going to have to deal with it. The way you deal with it is when you come home, you just binge on entertainment. You plop up on the couch, turn on the TV, and this is owed to you. This is how you cope. Most addictions come out of, most addictions are rescuers to victims. So you're addicted to drugs, you're addicted to alcohol because there's something that you're trying to cope with that you feel like you can't change. They use language like poor you, and it's okay, I'll take care of it for you. So as I said, the key role in this is the victim. This is the victim's orientation. What you focus on or your orientation determines the condition of your soul that drives your behavior. Okay, what you focus on determines the condition of your soul, your mind, will, and emotions that drives your behavior. So for the victim, they're focused on what they don't want. They're focused on the problem. And so when you're constantly focused on the problem, that creates a certain emotion in you, and then you start reacting out of it. Okay? What you're doing is you're actually, so for example, you have a problem. You focus on the problem, and when you focus on the problem, that creates anxiety. And then you react to your anxiety. You're not actually reacting to the problem. What you're reacting to is the way you feel. And so you're looking for a rescuer when you're a victim. You're looking for something that will help you feel better, not actually solve the problem. You just want to feel better. And so you find yourself either talking with people who act as rescuers. Oh, no, I'm so sorry, poor you. Let me take that and do that for you. And again, a lot of times that's done out of good intentions, but what we do is we just continue to perpetuate the victim mentality. We never challenge them to think about actually solving the problem. So this is victim orientation. So there's actually an alternative to that. Is this making sense to anybody? Okay. Sorry, you've just kind of been quiet. So I'm going to talk to this section right here because this is making sense to y'all. So there's actually an alternative to that way of living. Because in that way of living, life, you're not living life to its fullest. Okay, you constantly feel powerless, like you're being acted upon, and you're constantly looking for relief. Okay, there's another way to live, and that's what we're going to call the empowerment dynamic. If you'll notice this time, the creator is like the victim. The victim becomes the creator in the empowerment dynamic. The victim becomes the creator. The persecutor becomes the challenger, and the rescuer becomes the coach. If you'll notice in this dynamic, the creator is on top, not on bottom. Okay? They're on top. We could talk more about the challenger and coach, but I want to focus on the creator and how to make the shift from being a victim to being what we're going to call a creator. So the creator is aware of their current reality, but feels capable and confident. You're not lying to yourself saying there's no problem here. You know it, but you feel confident that you're able to find a solution and solve the problem. You're asking yourself, what is it that I really want? And you work towards that. Focus, so here's a huge thing. Focus is on a vision or outcome. Instead of the focus being on a problem, the focus is on a vision or outcome. Then you orient your thoughts and actions towards creating what you most want to see or experience in life. Victims focus on what they don't want, problems, while creators focus on what they do want. So we talked about the victim's orientation, where the focus is on the problem, and then that problem elicits certain emotions within you, whether it's anxiety or fear or stress. And then now you start reacting based on those feelings that you're experiencing. You just want to relieve those feelings. So now we're going to look at the creator orientation. The creator's orientation, what they focus on is the vision, which leads to passion and then action. So instead of focusing on the problem, you focus on what is it that you really want? What is it that God is calling you to do? What's God's way in this? Focus on where you want to go, what you want. And then as you keep a vision in front of you, that sparks passion. And now your behavior is a result of passion, not out of fear, anxiety, different things like that. So that's the shift, or that's the different players involved. Now I want to talk about the shift. How do you move from being a victim? Things aren't great at home because it's their fault. That's a victim mentality. You could go on and on. Always pushing blame, it's something else's fault, someone else's fault, And so that's why I just need space. That's why I just need fishing. Again, not that fishing's bad. I don't want to get stoned up here. But if you're using fishing to try to solve the problems in a serious relationship, yeah. You know, you feel like, God, you promised me a spouse, and here I am, still single, and I'm too tired to mingle. So where's it at, God? Where's it at? Focusing on your problem instead of focusing around your vision, things like that. So, first thing you need to do is you need to change the way you see yourself. How unbelievers get through this, I don't know. But I'm not talking to unbelievers, so I don't have to worry about that. I don't know how, as a believer, you can find yourself, and I don't know how you can fully embrace a victim mentality. I mean, I get how we can fall into it and things like that, but I don't see how you can really fully embrace and say, that's just the way it is. It's just gonna be like this. I don't know if you're a believer how you can actually do that. Because here's the deal. You need to change the way you see yourself, okay? When we talk about you, this is like our pastor's primary point, is identity, okay? He wrote a book about it. He's all about it. We've heard this so many times, but you need to change the way you see yourself. You are a new creation. You're more than a conqueror. You're the head and not the tail. You're above and not beneath. So whatever these things are that are coming up against you, as you approach them, it's not that the situation's changed. It's the way you see yourself has changed. And you're like, I'm going into this. I'm above and not beneath. There's a way. There's always a way. There's always a way. So first thing you need to do, change the way you see yourself. Second thing, change the way you see people, conditions, and circumstances in your life. I know this sounds crazy. So you're telling me that if I just change the way I see it, it'll make a difference. Yes. I don't get it. I don't know why. I just know it works. This particular passage, and there are so many like this, has been huge for me personally, and I know it's helped a lot of people that I've worked with from, of course, I've pastored youth. So it's been from bad breakups to parents going through a divorce, where this simple concept has totally changed everything. I want to read this to you, Romans 5. We can rejoice too when we run into problems and trials. What? We can rejoice when we run into trials and problems? That is the last thing I want to do. You know, I want to gripe about it. I want to just kind of soak in my problems, and hopefully a rescuer comes and finds me and it's like, oh no, it's going to be okay. I'm so sorry for you. But God's like, rejoice when you run into problems and trials, because we know that they help us develop endurance. I mean, we're talking about faith and patience here, right? Faith and patience inherit promises. For we know that they help us develop endurance, and endurance develops strength of character, and character strengthens our confident hope of salvation. And this hope, you're not hopeless, there's hope. This hope will not lead to disappointment. For we know how dearly God loves us, because he has given us his Holy Spirit to fill our hearts with his love. Man, when you've got to change the way you see the problems, the people. God, that person at work, my boss is a total tool. You need to change the way you see them. God, thank you that this is an opportunity for me to grow. Because one day I'm going to have to deal with a troubled person that thinks this way, and I'm going to be able to help them. Bless God. Change the way you see it. When you encounter that stuff, rejoice. Thank God, shift your focus. Third thing, orient your life around Jesus. Orient your life around Jesus. Focus on Jesus. Instead of orienting your life around the problems that you face, the circumstances you have, orient your life around Jesus. Hebrews 12 says this, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus. Let us run this race and strip away everything that tries to hold us down. looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. He didn't go to the cross with a victim mentality. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and he is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Orient your life around Jesus. I love first something that God's been talking to me personally about is in 1 Timothy. Paul's speaking to young Timothy, who's a young new leader, and he's encouraging him. And he says at the end of chapter 1, he's like, Timothy, here are some problems you got. Lays them out. And then he follows it up with this. So you're ready for like the problem-solving mode to kick in. Here it goes. This is what he says. He says, I want to encourage you to pray. But God, I got these problems. I want to encourage you to pray first, is what he said. Pray first. Why? Because when you pray, you're stepping away from your focus on the problem. You're shifting your focus. And when you pray, when you encounter problems, you're orienting yourself around Jesus. And you're looking to him, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. And when you do that, you realize that the problem isn't as big as it once was. And you're able to think more clearly, because when you're anxious, your options limit. You're able to think more clearly, and God will show you a way. Amen. I firmly believe there's always a way. There's always a way. I want to close with this. This passage in Isaiah 43. If you would, go ahead and stand up. We're going to close it out. We're going to go into a time of worship. It's going to be awesome. God's going to do something in your life. If you want it. If you don't, you're in the wrong place. All right, Isaiah 43. I am the Lord who opened a way through the waters, making a dry path through the sea. I called forth the mighty army of Egypt with all its chariots and horses. I drew them beneath the waves, and they drowned. Their lives snuffed out like a smoldering candle wick. But forget all that. It's nothing compared to what I'm going to do. For I'm about to do something new. See? Do you see it? I've already begun. I will make a pathway through the wilderness, and I'll create rivers in the dry wasteland. I will create rivers in the dry wasteland. He's going to make a way in the wilderness, and he's going to create rivers in the wasteland. The wild animals in the fields will thank me, the jackals and owls too, for giving them water in the desert. Yes, I will make rivers in the wasteland so my chosen people can be refreshed.